from WBUR Boston and NPR. I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. Chicago is desperate for an answer to gun violence. The gunfire does not stop. Shootings up yet another 50% so far this year. Chicago police have turned to predictive policing. Just 1,400 Chicagoans out of nearly 3 million bring most of the violence. The police are trying to predict who will shoot, who will be shot, and to intervene before the bloodshed. It's controversial. This hour, On Point, predictive policing in Chicago. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Is this the way? Does it sound like science fiction, like Minority Report? Does it sound effective? Does it sound fair? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Last week, a big raid. Before the summer months came in here, Chicago police out 140 arrests, a lot of those off what has been called the heat list. Algorithms put to work to say these are the people who may well be involved in violence. Here's Chicago Police Superintendent Eddie Johnson on Friday talking about that crackdown before summer hits Chicago.
140 offenders have been arrested, 95 of whom are documented gang members, and 117 are on the department's strategic subject list. Additionally, 23 weapons were seized, over $45,000 worth of narcotics, 278 packs of unstamped cigarettes, and over $7,000 in currency.
Joining me first today from Chicago is Jeremy Gorner. He covers crime in the Chicago Police Department for the Chicago Tribune. Jeremy, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Tom.
So I'm looking at just, today, out of the Tribune. I mean, it's unbelievable the amount of gunfire you've got in the city. You just look down the list, and it's just like almost every hour on the hour, shot in the back, shot in the hand, critically wounded, shot in the chest, grazed hand, shot on the porch, shot in the park, shot in the foot. Does Chicago feel like it's being overwhelmed?
Well, I think, not to trivialize matters, I know that there's always a lot of people saying that with the 24-hour news cycle, of course, now more than ever, we're focusing on violence, it seems. Of course, the violence isn't what it was 20 years ago. It was far more severe. However, this year we're seeing homicide and homicide statistics that are as bad as they were in the late 90s, which is pretty unheard of. You're seeing weekends where there's more than 50 people shot already, and it's not even summer yet. And now we're going into Memorial Day weekend. So, of course, this is this is kind of like the time of year where the police department always asks for more officers to volunteer to work the weekends because, every year there's always, a high propensity for violence on Memorial Day.
Can you explain what happened last Friday with this big raid? 140, we now understand, arrested, and the police department using their strategic subject list. I guess it used to be called the heat list. What is that? How is it compiled, and how is it used, Jeremy?
So a lot of these people were, most of them were arrested on narcotics and guns charges on the west side, very, crime-ridden part of the city. The list is actually compiled. They look at basically people's arrest histories. A lot of these are gang members who have arrest histories, some for guns, some for narcotics. You don't necessarily, just from writing about this before, you don't necessarily have to be the most hardened criminal to get on this list, Tom. It really depends mostly on who your associations are. So say you've been arrested with people for minor crimes like marijuana possession,
okay,
or gambling or whatever. And the people that you happen to be repeatedly arrested with, you look them up, and they later became a homicide victim, or they later became shooting victims. The logic is that puts you at risk of becoming the next homicide or shooting victim. So there's a good chance that you could end up on the list for that reason, because you're associating with other people who have been victims of violence.
But are they arresting people who are going to become victims, or people who are going to become shooters, or are they the same population?
Both. It's the same population. I mean, the logic is, and I know I've heard police officials say this, today's offender could be tomorrow's victim, or vice versa, basically.
I mean, you describe here in your piece this algorithm. It looks at criminal background, parole, warrant status, weapons or drug arrests, but also, as you say, acquaintances and their acquaintances' arrest histories. I guess this builds a kind of profile of vulnerability or to being a victim or likely of being a shooter.
Yeah, likely being, exactly, Tom, like being a victim or a shooter. And when I say acquaintances, that's kind of what we just talked about is, you know, these acquaintances could be people who've been arrested for murder, you know, arrested for shooting. I mean, there's that. But again, like I said, you don't have to be the most hardened criminal to get on the list. You could be associated and arrested with people who have been victims, have been shooting victims themselves. And that could put you at risk for being a shooting victim. So I guess the next step that the department has is this custom notification program where they send commanders and, you know, somebody who deals with the community who's big on, like, social services and knows a lot about that, to basically tell these people on the list, look, because of your criminal background, you are at risk of either becoming a victim of violence or becoming an offender, and we're going to prosecute you to the fullest extent of the law, and we're going to keep an eye on you. However, at the same time, we're here to help you. And that's where the other person, who's a civilian, who works with social services, basically tells these people that, you know, we could assist you in trying to find job training or substance abuse counseling or other housing options, other social services that may help you and get you out of this criminal life. So they're going off that strategic subject list to try to help some of these people. In that regard,
bring the threat of arrest, also bring the offer of some kind of help. That's a tough combination to juggle, I guess. People may just want to flee, but it's all off of this algorithm, the strategic subject list, and big action on that front just last Friday. Jeremy Gorner reports on it all for the Chicago Tribune. Jeremy, thanks for joining us from Chicago Today.
Thank you, Tom.
Lots of Chicagoans have been hit by this. Here's Dawn Watson. She lost her nephew to gun violence this month. She was at a rally in Chicago to stop the violence. Talked to WGN-TV.
My nephew was actually killed Mother's Day weekend. And, you know, we're just here to let that devil know that Chicago does not belong to him, that we belong to God.
Raven Humphrey showed up at the same event. She lost two cousins to gun violence.
We're showing up now. We're letting you know that we're not going to be quiet about this anymore. We want change. And we know that, you know, it starts within the community. It starts within the homes. It starts within the hearts of people.
Murder rate through the roof. Jesse Jackson, Reverend Jesse Jackson, same rally. WGN-TV saying there are reasons.
Some combination of poverty and drugs and guns is creating this situation.
And the Chicago police responding with predictive policing algorithms, trying to see who is most likely to shoot, who's most likely to be shot. Simone Weichselbaum joins me now from New York. She's a staff writer at the Marshall Project, a nonprofit news organization that writes about the criminal justice system. Her piece, in collaboration with Time Magazine, was headlined, "The Chicago Model of Policing Hasn't Saved Chicago." Simone, thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
I mean, I guess we can see that it hasn't saved Chicago, but how long have they really been using it? And do you think predictive policing is proving not to work in your study here?
So there are certain variations of the Chicago model, and for your show, we'll talk about the custom notification, which is based on the work of David Kennedy, who's a professor here at John Jay in New York. So what I had found, I spent about 3 weeks during January and February in Chicago, really looking hard about how are they using this model? How are they using the strategic subject list, which actually is about 3 or 4 years old? It's nothing really new here.
Right.
So the issue is, okay, how are they putting this list together? It's a mystery. And I'm so excited you have Chief Lewin from the Chicago Police Department on the show later on, so hopefully he can shed light. But it's very interesting that even the professors involved with this program don't know how the model is made. They don't know how the list is actually put together, which I found extremely odd. So what I did find from speaking to different street cops who work on this, there are certain questions that they ask when they're trying to figure out who to put on this list. Things of who's convicted of a gun offense. Are you on parole? Do you have a felony conviction? Things of that. But we actually don't know what other the elements are. One officer told me there's about 12 or 14 questions they ask when they're putting this list together. So I'm hoping that's something we can expand on today on this show, definitely. But then what's interesting, so they have this list. They're not arresting everyone on the list. Some people are being arrested. Some people are being looked at a little harder by the street cops. But what's also interesting are these door knocks, these custom notifications. They show up at the homes of the folks on this list, and they either talk to that person or a female family member, which I also found interesting. So just because they're like, we're here, we're doing a door knock, let's count that in our book, doesn't mean they actually talk to the individual on the list. It could be I'm a girlfriend. It could be a wife. It could be the mom. And they sort of check that box. And then they come back a second time and they say, yes, here is a visitor too from the community. And we can offer you GED. We can offer you job services.
Education, job service. Okay.
Mm-hmm. That does happen.
But it's just where they're also sort of laying down the law and saying, you're on our list. We're watching you. You may be shot. You may commit murder. We'll prosecute you to the full extent of the law. Is this the conversation where that happens?
Right. But here's the problem, Tom. Just because you're door knocking and you're giving someone a warning, you're giving them this offer of here are some social services, they're not really following up. They just follow up once via phone call or via an additional door knock 4 to 6 months later. So sort of the issues and the questions I have is, okay, you identify these people, you're going to their homes, but how are you seeing this through? How are you making sure they're not going to reoffend? How are you reassuring they may not end up in jail or shot again? And that's a big problem here in Chicago. It's such a vast, big city with resource issues. The city has a budget crisis. The state has a budget crisis. It's not just so much of putting people on a list and door knocking them or putting people on a list and arresting them. You have to do more.
The chief says 1,300 to 1,400 people are responsible for an overwhelming volume of the violence in Chicago. Can you blame them for trying to figure out who those people are and trying to intervene?
No, but my question is sort of my issue and what I challenge them to do isn't so much intervening. It's not so much interviewing them or threatening them or warning them. It's how do you convince them to change their lifestyle? And it's a huge issue in Chicago because it's not just a policing problem. It's a poverty problem. I spent 3 weeks in the toughest police district, the 11th district, January and February, bitter cold. 10 a.m., there were guys on the corner selling drugs. At 10 a.m., you do not see that in the Bronx or in Brooklyn or Philadelphia or other cities where I've worked. It was shocking to me.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about predictive policing in Chicago. Police using an algorithm to pinpoint who's likely to kill or be killed, then getting on their case in advance. Chicago's desperate to stop a wave of gun deaths. Critics say it doesn't work. It may trample civil liberties, but they're looking to do something there. 2002 film Minority Report, well, that's the science fiction version. Tom Cruise plays the head of a pre-crime unit, they call it. It uses psychic technology to foresee crime and try to stop it. Hear from the trailer.
Look at me. Positive for Howard Marks. I'm placing you under arrest for the future murder of Sarah Marks and Donald Dubin that was to take place today, April 22nd, at 0800 hours and 4 minutes.
No.
Okay, that's science fiction, but it's coming. It's something like that. Here's a company called Hunch Lab. They sell predictive policing software. From a video, they explain how their program works.
Most predictive policing begins with a grid, dividing a city into squares that can be as small as half a block.
Beginning with data of previous crimes, computer programs create a forecast for each square, estimating the risk of a crime occurring there during a precinct's next four-hour shift.
A lot of cities are now using that kind of software. Every city may have its own way. Chicago has its own. Here's Deputy Police Chief Eric Carter in Chicago talking Friday about the arrest of 140 people there last week in an effort to try and stop killings in Chicago.
We approach our target locations holistically by using input directly from the aldermen, tips and feedback from the community members, in addition to intelligence that CPD already has on these areas. So it was the perfect example of the community partnering with the department to make our streets safer.
We're going to talk in just a second here with Deputy Chief Jonathan Lewin from Chicago. You can join this conversation. Do you want police predicting who's going to commit a crime, who's going to be a victim, when 1,300 to 1,400 Chicagoans out of nearly 3 million commit most of the violence? Is it right to hone in on them, hone in on them like crazy maybe, or is this a recipe for prejudice, for prejudging? Simone Weichselbaum is with us from the Marshall Project in New York. And joining us right now from Washington is Deputy Chief of the Chicago Police Department's Technology and Records Group, who oversees crime mapping and predictive policing. Deputy Chief Jonathan Lewin joins us. Chief Lewin, thank you so much for being here.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
How does it work, or how do you hope it works, sir?
It works by looking at kind of objective measures of a subject's crime records. It does not use anything about race, nothing about gender, nothing about ethnicity, nothing about geography, but it uses some proven variables that through testing have been shown to have predictive value to identify those subjects who are most at risk for what we call future violence. We call them parties to violence. So the model can't necessarily tell if they're going to be a victim or an offender, but it knows that they're going to be involved.
What kind of variables are on the list? What do you use, Chief Lewin?
So it's things like, have you been shot before? Do you have weapons arrests, unlawful use of weapons arrests in your history? the age, your age at the time you were last arrested. The lower the age, the higher the risk. Your trend line in criminal activity, is it increasing or decreasing? It's the kind of things that you would think might have value, and the model shows that they do.
So when the police went out last Friday in Chicago and rounded up 140 people and arrested them, were those like the hottest names on the so-called strategic subject list?
They tend to be. They tend to be very high, what we call scores. And, of course, you know, the score is basically the risk score of their potential to be involved in future violence. And as you said, you know, it's a very tiny fraction of Chicago's population that comprise the riskiest people on this list.
You've been using this system for several years now, and yet the level of gun death is still headed kind of straight up. What does that tell us?
Well, this is a tool. I mean, and it's not designed to replace other tools. It's part of a comprehensive, you know, set of tools, that, you know, one of which was talked about at the press conference by Deputy Chief Carter. But it's something that we hope, along with other strategies and other emerging technology, will, you know, help us reduce violent crime in the city.
So the list has people on who you think may be shooters or may be shot. That seems to present a strange challenge for the police. You don't know if they're the victim or the perpetrator, or do you see them as potentially both? Explain that to us.
So, yeah, it could be both. I mean, future versions of the model, because we're on version 4, version 5 is going to be ready to roll out. Each version becomes a little bit more predictive. The current version is more than twice as predictive as the first version, which rolled out. So the intervention strategies are customized based on the subject, and it's not necessarily always going to be punitive. Sometimes it could be social services. It could be what we call a custom notification, which is based on the work of Dr. David Kennedy at John Jay College in New York,
yeah,
where a subject is visited and a range of social services could be provided, because at the end of the day, this is about saving lives.
Chief Lewin, I've got Simone Weichselbaum with us from the Marshall Project. She's done a lot of study on Chicago and your setup there. I wonder if I could just bring her in for a moment. Simone, you've got questions about how the list put together.
I have so many questions. So it's a pleasure to speak with you, Chief Lewin. I had asked multiple times to speak to folks in the police department through my reporting.
Here you are.
Just
fire
to talk
away
about this. It's my time to shine. I'm so excited. Thank you, Tom, for this opportunity. So one of the first things I wanted to talk about is the way you evaluate the success of someone being on the heat list. So different people gave me different answers. So is it so much that you're arresting them? Does that mean it's successful? Does it mean you show up through a custom notification and they stop reoffending over X amount of time? Like, what do you guys consider a success when someone is on the SSL and they've been identified?
Chief Lewin?
Well, I would consider it that they live. I would consider that, you know, that we're reducing the likelihood that they're going to be victimized. So as part of the Department of Justice, Bureau of Justice Assistance grant that's actually funding this, RAND Corporation is the evaluation partner, and they're going to be putting together a very comprehensive evaluation methodology to look at just that, to look at the impact, look at the efficacy of the model, look at how it's operationalized, and that's something that we look forward to.
And why the lack of transparency? It was very interesting to me. David Kennedy himself, Chris Millett himself, who runs VRS in Chicago, none of them seem to know exactly what makes up the heat list. Why aren't, not necessarily not telling the media, but not telling your law enforcement partners? Why the secrecy?
We do tell them. In fact, we're doing a presentation as we speak at the International Association of Chiefs of Police, where we are showing the model, describing it to other interested departments around the country and around the world. So there's a lot of interest in this because it's kind of a new technology, but we want it to be transparent.
Chief Lewin, are you customizing this for Chicago? Are you using a package off the shelf? I know you can buy predictive policing software. Do you use your own or a package outfit?
This is customized for Chicago, and it was developed by the Illinois Institute of Technology through that federal funding.
We've got callers for you as well. Matt in Key Largo, Florida. You're on with the Deputy Chief of Technology and Records at the Chicago Police Department. Hi, Matt.
Hi, Tom. Just a little bit concerned hearing all these different ways of policing. Hear things like, it just sounds a lot to me like 1984, thought police. You know, I don't want to go that far, but I just feel like we keep giving up our rights to privacy. I feel like, you know, I'm hearing 140 people were arrested. On what grounds? You know, are people just going and being taken in because they're on this list?
Well, no, there were weapons and narcotics charges, I guess, but let me put it to Chief Lewin. Chief Lewin, what about the concern that this may go too far. It may lead to giving up rights. It sounds like 1984 to our caller. And what about the arrest and the grounds for those 140 arrests?
Well, again, as you said, when there's an arrest, there's only an arrest if there's probable cause for the arrest. So being on the list does not mean that you're going to get arrested just because you're on the list. It also does not mean that because your friend is on the list that you're going to get arrested. This list is based on evidence. It's based on objective indicators that we can prove increase a subject's risk for future violence. So, again, the interventions are not designed to be punitive. Always they're designed to be life-saving. So the custom notification that we just talked about, as you know, that's not an arrest. That's a visit to try to provide services that's going to reduce the chance that one of these subjects is going to get killed.
Do you have the services to bring to bear once you've got someone on this list? When you come to their door, I mean, what can you really do for them? I'm reading numbers here about, you know, how bad unemployment is in Chicago, racial employment gaps, inequality sort of off the charts. Can you show up with enough to really offer them a path out of their predicament?
I think we can. I think there's a range of services that are available. And, of course, this is not just a police issue. This is it's a comprehensive social services provider response that includes things like job training, includes things like maybe child care services if that's needed, includes an entire range of both public and private sector assistance services that can be made available if somebody wants to take advantage of them.
Predictive policing in Chicago with social services right alongside. Murder rate still very high, but there's a taste of what goes into the effort. Deputy Chief Jonathan Lewin heads up the Technology and Records Group for the Chicago Police Department. Chief Lewin, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you, Tom. I appreciate it.
Simone Weichselbaum, please stand by. I want to bring in Norman Livingston Kerr. He's Vice President for Violence Prevention at UCAN. It's a local anti-violence group, works with at-risk youth in Chicago, joins us from Chicago. Norman Kerr, thanks so much for being here. What do you think of the predictive policing effort? Is it effective to your mind? Is it a good thing, Norman?
Hi, Tom. I think we really need to focus on the interventions. So there was some mention about social services, and I believe that, you know, when you're doing outreach work, when you're trying to develop relationships with high-risk individuals, it can't just be a situation where you're working with them, you know, you're trying one time or two times. This is a population that is really hard to penetrate, and it takes a lot of persistence and constant contact with them to really build that relationship to help them turn their lives around.
Do you see that kind of contact associated with the predictive policing program, the strategic subject list, Norman?
I think, as was mentioned before, there's a couple visits that may happen, but I don't see it as something that's really consistent. I think you reach out to them sometimes, and then, you know, you kind of leave them to do their own thing, and then they end up, you know, getting shot or reshot or getting arrested for another charge. We believe that it really takes on the ground, constant going to them every day, bugging them, leaving the door open in a constant way. For them to really see that intervention and really take advantage of that.
I want to go to our listeners, Holly in Columbia, Missouri. Holly, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Thank you, Tom.
Mm-hmm. What do you see?
So my issue with predictive policing is that the American justice system is based on the ideal that every person is innocent until proven guilty. And I worry a little bit that predictive policing sort of trods on that, in the fact that we're kind of deciding who is guilty ahead of time. And what if those people who are put on that list, what if getting arrested because of this program, or what if, you know, if their name somehow gets out that they're on the list, what if that ruins their opportunity to get a job or to better themselves, all because the police department has said that they might do something?
Holly, let us pick it up, and I appreciate your call from Missouri there. Simone, how about it? The ACLU in Chicago has had a lot of complaints about this. You hear Holly's concern that somehow people are going to be disadvantaged. It's outside the American tradition, outside the sort of proper rhythm here, not, you know, innocent until proven guilty.
Well, being on the SSL is not a marker of your criminal record. It's internal, like, police department documents, so that's not something an employer could find. So there is sort of this disbelief out there that at least with Chicago, if you're put on this list, you know, it's a marker for life. And unfortunately, a lot of people on this list already have a criminal history, already have a felony history.
Yeah.
So it's sort of those consequences are attached to that person already, which is extremely unfortunate. But I just wanted to jump on something Norman had mentioned and also what the chief have talked about, mm-hmm. sort of the social service component. And again, I spent about 6 months looking into this issue. And I hate to say this, but just because an officer and someone from social services, which is generally a nonprofit, so the way it works is each police district in Chicago works with the officers in that police district and then a nonprofit organization. So I spent a lot of time with the 11th District Liaison, which is the west side of Chicago, which usually has the highest homicide rate year after year. And what I found in the reporting is they show up one more time. They make one more phone call, just one more phone call or one more visit. They are not seeing these men and women through. And that's a big issue. And it's really hard to point the finger at the police department or the social services because they just don't have the manpower. They just don't have the budgets.
They've got big problems. I mean, I'm looking here at a report says Chicago's racial employment gap, worst among the worst in the nation. This is out of Brookings. Among 20 to 24-year-olds, Chicago's area's unemployment rate, 47% for blacks, the lowest employment rate among big cities. It's 73% employment for whites, which is among the highest. Almost a quarter of black 20 to 24-year-olds in Chicago disconnected from work and school, almost a quarter, compared with 3.3% of whites. I mean, only Philadelphia and Los Angeles come close to this kind of stark black-white racial gap when it comes to employment and school and work. And there's a lot going on. There's the shootings just off the chain. Lawrence in Memphis, Tennessee. Lawrence, thank you for calling.
Hi, Tom. I was compelled to call when I heard the topic. The situation down here is that it's my blues ain't like yours or yours ain't like mine. Mm. And recently, as if it were some kind of a race, there was a blurb on something I read or maybe heard on local news that Memphis had exceeded Chicago in deaths. Like that's,
wow.
You know, some trophy.
That's saying a lot, so, yeah.
The thing that I see here is, I mean, you were talking about predictive policing. I don't think that they can afford to have predictive policing. The police department ran off a lot of their people, and that was not the police department's decision. You have to think it was from somewhere above them. And the way they ran a lot of the city officers off was by taking away all of their benefits, health, everything. You know, and it sounded, you know, I'm not an expert in this at all in terms of who and why and when, but that it was a chamber of commerce kind of thing, pressure. Nonetheless, it's if you go out, you're taking your life in your hands.
But in Memphis, people, Lawrence, in Memphis, would you be happier if police there did some predictive policing? Perhaps they are doing it. I don't know. But if you can figure out who's most likely to be doing the shooting, would you like special attention there, or are you afraid of that?
No, I'm not afraid of that. The thing is, anytime you have a system like that, it has to be maintained, and you have to know who's maintaining it because it is, in fact, a system. It's not something that you do lightly and not understand that it can go places you may not have wanted it to or couldn't have predicted. So that's always going to be an issue. The thing I really called about is that at 10 o'clock, and it's 10 o'clock news here instead of 11 on the East Coast,
yep.
And at 10 o'clock, the first 10 minutes, I kid you not, is one murder after another. And it's always kids, or it's somebody who did something to the girlfriend. I mean, it just goes on and on and on and on and on.
Yeah.
And there is another police department that is Shelby County, and they're called the Sheriff's Department. And a lot of the guys, not just guys, a lot of the Memphis Police Department that left went to work there. And when I see one of those guys, and it seems like I have an opportunity or an opening to ask them how it's going, what do they think, I have yet to hear one of them say they made a mistake by going there.
Another sort of flare going up there from Memphis, Tennessee, saying we've got problems too. Chicago just off the charts so far this year. Predictive policing is being used to try and stop that. But is it actually working? That's our subject today. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. We're talking this hour about predictive policing in Chicago, police using an algorithm to pinpoint who's likely to kill or be killed, then getting on their case in advance. Chicago, of course, at this point desperate to stop a wave of gun deaths. Critics say it doesn't work and it tramples civil liberties. You can join us this hour. What do you think? If predictive policing is so great, why are Chicago's gun death numbers still soaring? Can we, will we, with this program, deliver the social services to head off crime before it happens? Is this a recipe for bringing murders down, a recipe for prejudice, prejudging? Norman Livingston Kerr is with us. He's at the violence prevention effort at UCAN. It's a local anti-violence group in Chicago that works with at-risk youth. So he sees it right from the street level. Simone Weichelbaum is with us from the Marshall Project, the nonprofit news organization that writes about criminal justice. Her recent piece was headlined, "The Chicago Model of Policing Hasn't Saved Chicago." I guess that's pretty clear from the numbers so far. But people are trying all kinds of things. They're just desperate. Here's a Montessori school in Englewood. It's a neighborhood plagued by violence. Students learning yoga to help them control their emotions. The day of this taping, the school went on lockdown because of a nearby shooting. This is from Al Jazeera, broadcast in January.
It can help you, like, calm down when you get angry.
Pull it back.
It helps cool you down and, like, same thing, it helps cool your mind down.
Bend down when you look at me before you do it. You have your hand and you...
People desperate for anything. I'm reading Britt Julius here in Esquire recently writing, this has just become the way that arguments are settled in too much of Chicago. So she says, this is a cult, not just a gang problem, it's a cultural problem. And of course, it's not just emotion. She says generational poverty, crumbling infrastructure, segregation, class divides. But you've got it deep now. Here's a woman in her 40s got caught in the crossfire of a shooting Friday, and Chicago Police Superintendent Eddie Johnson responded to this incident.
We know that the intended target is a documented gang member. But again, it illustrates how people have weapons in the city of Chicago, and they don't mind using them.
That is quite clear. Simone Weichelbaum, Norman Livingston Kerr, stand by. Eric Pisa joins us right now from New York. He's a professor at John Jay College of Criminal Justice, studies crime analytics, was formerly in the Newark, New Jersey Police Department. Eric Pisa, thank you very much for being with us.
Hello, Tom. Thank you for having me.
Chicago's system of predictive policing is a little different from some others. What sets it apart, Eric?
Well, actually, I'm glad you asked, right, because I've been listening to the program, and when we say predictive police, I think it's important to state that Chicago's model is just one model of a large range of analytic tools that fall under that umbrella.
Yep.
Now, Chicago has obviously put together the high offender list, or the high-risk offender list, rather, but I think it's important to state that most place-based analysis, and I mean most predictive analysis, has been very place-based focused, right? So rather than focus on the individuals that police target, most algorithms actually try to pinpoint the micro places within an area that should be targeted.
The geographic likelihood of a crime somewhere.
Yes, yes. And actually, you played one snippet of a predictive policing product earlier, and that one was actually a place-based software, yeah. Not a person-based software.
Yeah. So Chicago is person-centric. What does that tell you?
Looking at the actual algorithm, I think there's two important questions to ask, right? One is the prediction accurate, right? Is the output that the algorithm gives the police, is it beneficial in terms of predicting the people that should be targeted? And if you look at some of the media coverage, and also if you look at some analyses done in other cities, this type of social network analysis does have a high level of predictive capacity. It does seem to do a sufficient job of identifying the people and, conversely, the places, going back to the other example, that are most at risk of future violence. I think the important question that police need to figure out, and to be honest, I think maybe a little behind the curve, at least in compared to testing the actual algorithms, is how do you make this information actionable? I mean, it's one thing to have a predictive product identify accurately where your resources should be dedicated. It's another question to identify exactly what you should do with that information.
Norman Kerr in Chicago, people must talk about this list. How is it seen in the community? Are people happy that the police have this strategic subject list and that they're acting on it? Are they suspicious of it? How is it perceived, Norm?
I mean, the average person is not talking about this list. I mean, I think people aren't surprised to hear about it because they know that police are doing, you know, different strategies, and they probably don't know about them. So they're not surprised that something like this is happening. But it's not commonplace that there's conversation around the police having this list. I do want to add that with the program that I work on, I mean, we work in a predictive way as well. I mean, we do street outreach, and we identify young people to take into our program based on their family history. So they may have family members that were involved in the lifestyle, whether they've been shot recently or arrested for, you know, a violent crime. And we use that information to engage them and develop a relationship with them. So I think the key is that we have to, again, I'm going to stress this with this intervention piece of it, we have to build relationships with them and really guide them into this other lifestyle. I mean, we can offer it and say, you know, if you don't do this and accept this phone call or make a change in a week, you're going to get arrested. We can do that all day long. We fill up our prisons and our kids come back out and they're more violent. Or we could say, you know what, we got this list. And why don't we really come at them really strong with resources and support, because we know the impact that they have on our communities and in our city, and then we'll see change that way if we really put mm-hmm. those resources into that.
Simone, is your fundamental critique here that the list might be helpful, but they don't bring the resources to bear on these young people, generally young people, to change their path?
That is correct. It's about the implementation of the list. So not only arrests, but when you're doing these custom notifications, it's not just showing up one more extra time or making an additional phone call. But I want to make another point. I spent a lot of time with the street cops, and some of those officers got to go on these custom notification visits. And I just want mm-hmm. to read a quote from one.
Yes.
This didn't make it into my final draft, but I pulled it out of the earlier drafts anyway. Mm-hmm. And one of the officers said to me, quote, "You can use any algorithm you want, but the policemen on the street know what's going to happen if they're out there. You can make all the lists you want, but someone who is high ranking may not have been locked up for 6 years versus the guy out there who are constantly doing this stuff." And what he was trying to say is that, hey, you know what? Talk to us. Don't rely too much on this mystery algorithm that even the street cops don't really know how this list is being put together. Talk to us. Get human intelligence. We know which guys are being released from Cook County in the next few days. We know which guys are warring with the other guys over street corners. So they also felt insulted and actually had no respect for the list either. So it's interesting. You have pushback from the community and from the street cops when it comes to this SSL.
Eric, do you see that in your research? Police saying, look, if you want to know who's the troublemaker, just ask me. I know. Don't give me a list from some computer.
Well, actually, that's kind of what I was getting at when I said that we have this question of how do you make the intelligence actionable. It's not enough just to take an algorithm and, you know, look at it like an easy button. Oh, we have this list, or we have this predictive policing place-based type of model, whatever it is, and think that in and of itself is going to help you solve the crime problem. It takes partnerships. It takes trying to understand exactly how the police can use this list a little bit more differently than they used to in the past. How can they fine-tune some of their existing efforts to better attack the crime problem based upon the structure as the list may suggest? So there's a whole host of pieces of information that need to go into making this type of stuff actionable.
Let's go to Corey in Woodstock, Georgia. Corey, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, thank you. So I just had I just want to comment on more broad scope of this. I mean, you know, we live in the era of big data.
Yeah.
We live in, you know, just after, you know, the NSA leaks and that sort of thing. What is to prevent this type of technology from being added to another national surveillance system? I mean, we look at these types of things, and I'm all for supporting law enforcement, but, you know, if they get more computing power, more data, how is this not going to be put across the country?
I mean, consumers are already tracked and sliced and diced in a million ways by commercial interests. Eric, is that a concern of yours that this could become more and more sophisticated till everybody has a law enforcement profile and shows up somewhere ranked for I don't know what kind of vulnerability or risk?
To be honest, I think that may be a little bit too paranoid. If you look at predictive policing, a lot of what the goals are in this type of analysis are actually the same goals that police have had for the last 20 or 30 years. Things like problem-oriented policing, things like intelligence-led policing are efforts that the police have been doing for decades. Predictive policing only means that we have new data sources to leverage in that type of analysis. So while we tend to, you know, use the phrase predictive policing as this new thing that came out of nowhere, it's really, if you look carefully, just the next logical iteration of the crime analysis process. Now, with that said, you know, there are obviously potential there's potential for abuse or misallocation of this type of information, definitely. Right? So police should always be mindful of that and draft interventions in a way that just not only seek to reduce crime, but to do so in a fair process.
We're talking about predictive policing in Chicago. Jay in Cleveland, Ohio. Jay, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hey, how's it going?
Okay.
So the last caller just talked about the similarities to the NSA program, so I'm not really going to get into that, although I do share his concern. One of the other things that I was, you know, when we continue to hear about the problems that police have in regards to crime, and especially in where I'm from, where we're not the top, but we're pretty close, is that I think a lot of this conversation ignores the underlying structural issues that cause all this crime. You know, massive disenfranchisement of the community, the separation between community and police, all of which is, you know, amplified by bad policies on us.
Yeah, Jay, you're breaking up on us, but I mean, I tried to lay some of those out here because Chicago certainly has big ones. Very, very high unemployment rates for minorities there. A quarter of 20 to 25-year-old blacks in Chicago disconnected from work and school. That's a lot of people compared to 3.3% of whites. That is a lot of people without a lot to do. And, of course, yes, the police history there, we know, all know it vividly. Laquan McDonald shot 16 times by a white police officer and all the distress over that. I think we lost you, but let me get one more from Detroit, if I may. Stephen in Detroit, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I don't think that predictive policing is necessarily bad. I just think that the problem's a little bit one-sided in the sense that we don't focus enough on education as a public safety issue. If you look at any big urban city, like, I guess, formerly Detroit, where I'm from, but Chicago, New York, Los Angeles, these places all have failing, if not just substandard schools. So if we gave students an incentive to stay in school, maybe some of this extracurricular stuff like intervention programs could work, but I don't think that we address the foundation of, or at least a big foundation of the crime issue.
Yeah, I appreciate your call so much from Detroit, Stephen. I mean, Simone, the same thing occurred to me. I understand Chicago's desperate to get on top of this, and you got 1,300 people who are maybe committing a lot of the violent crime there, but when you go and try and fix their circumstance, it's part of a bigger fabric, and in that fabric, you've got almost a quarter of black Chicagoans, 20 to 24, not in work or school. That just sounds like a general environment that doesn't work.
That is correct. So the issue is, it's not all roads here when you want to start pointing fingers in Chicago. They don't lead to police headquarters per se. Mm-hmm. I think they also lead to City Hall and also to the State House. Look at the problem in Illinois right now. They haven't had a budget in months. When I was spending time in the 11th Police District actually talking to the nonprofit workers who make these visits with the officers, some of them are nervous. They may lose state funding. They may be no more workers to make those door knocks. And there's a bigger conversation to be had. It's politics, state and local politics are so intertwined with this policing conversation in our country. And if I will, I just wanted to make another point,
yes,
piggybacking on what Eric had said, looking at the national trends of predictive policing. My colleague Marie Chamat at the Marshall Project did an excellent piece a few months ago called Policing the Future, which walks the reader through the history of predictive policing and actually goes back to 1800s, looking at CompStat, the notion of hotspot policing, which was really big in the 90s. It's nothing new. Mm-hmm. It just sort of has a new tone to it, something Will Bratton at the time in L.A. sort of coined the term predictive policing. It's just really CompStat on steroids, if you will. Mm-hmm. And it's a really good story because Maurice got to spend time in St. Louis and do ride-alongs with these officers as they're going to these hotspots, which the computer, in this case, Hunch Lab, had identified. So I think if a lot of your listeners check out that story, a lot of their concerns, a lot of their anxieties about predictive policing may be put to bed.
Hunch Lab, hotspots.
mean, Norman, can we get on top of this by trying to have police in exactly the right place and exactly the right time to stop the shooting? The reports I read out of Chicago, there's so much shooting, I don't know if they have enough police to even begin to do it.
I think that would help, but I think we have to have more proactive work as far as workers in the communities building relationships with those individuals who are on the list or those that aren't on the list that could be on the list. That's a whole other population that could be younger that haven't had the rap sheets and the history, and they're not known as much, but they could be on the list as well. But I think those relationships have to be built in a proactive way to help prevent it.
Is this the future, Eric Pisa? Is this where, I mean, I'm reading already about plenty of law enforcement communities going here, Los Angeles and Atlanta and Seattle and, you know, Albuquerque and Berkeley and Manchester, New Hampshire. Is this where it's going? Predict and be there.
I think we're here already, Tom. I think the vast majority of American police departments have been using data for quite some time to, frankly, try to do more with less. And predictive policing is the current age of them trying to get ahead of the crime problem.
To do more with less, does that mean that part of it is premised on the idea that we're not going to have the same funding, the same resources available?
Well, I think so. And I actually wanted to piggyback off of a very important point Simone made. Is that, you know, a lot of this may not be a policing problem, right? Going back to the context of Chicago, answering why an individual person may be at high risk for committing a crime is only part of the answer, right? I mean, the next part of the answer is what exactly should be done to mitigate the factors that led to that individual getting on the list in the first place. Now, certainly, some of that may be police-related, and police can probably do some things, but there's probably a whole host of things that the police have no control over.
And that is a big list indeed. Eric Pisa, we're out of time right there, but I'm grateful to you for being with us today from the John Jay College of Criminal Justice in New York. Simone Weichselbaum at the Marshall Project, Norman Livingston Kerr at UCAN in Chicago. Thanks to all of you. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.